Donald Trump's first press conference since the election.
They tax us, we tax them. And they tax us almost in all cases, they're taxing us, and we haven't been taxing yet.
Residents are returning to Aleppo following Assad's fall.
Locals say the markets here are getting busier every day. And we meet people from all over Syria, as well as Syrians who have returned from abroad after living as refugees for years.
And another school shooting in the U.S.
A teenage student opened fire at a private Christian school in Wisconsin, killing a teacher and another teenage student in the final week before Christmas break.
Today is Tuesday, December 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. President-elect Donald Trump hosted a press conference on Monday, his first since the election in November. The press conference was called to announce a large investment in the U.S. for AI technology from SoftBank CEO Masayoshi Son.
But what I would note is similar to what used to happen time and again during the first Trump administration, there was a big, seemingly positive announcement, and Donald Trump talked about a lot of other things that seemed to even overshadow the big news that he was trotting out.
That's Steve Herman, VOA's chief national correspondent.
But I think we do have to note that the big intended announcement was he had this Japanese entrepreneur next to him at Mar-a-Lago, Masayoshi Son, and he was announcing that his company, SoftBank, would invest $100 billion in the U.S. economy while Trump is president again, creating supposedly 100,000 jobs. And then, but we do have to note this wasn't the first time we've heard this type of announcement. With Masayoshi Son, there was an announcement previously in 2016. He made a $50 billion pledge. It really didn't pan out. And there was also the announcement that Trump touted in Wisconsin with a Taiwanese chip manufacturer to build a big project there, and that never happened. So there are the caveats on that.
Along with a business deal with SoftBank, Trump also took reporters' questions on a wide range of subjects. The president-elect reiterated his plan for Ukraine peace negotiations, as well as his hyperbolic claim that the war wouldn't have happened if he were in office.
What should Zelensky, if anything, be prepared to give up to Alice?
He should be prepared to make a deal. That's all. Got to be a deal. No, got to be a deal. Too many people being killed. That is a war that's hard. Too many people. Got to make a deal. And Putin has to make a deal.
What's the deal? What do you throw the way?
Truth has to make a deal, and Putin would have never gotten in if I was president.
He also reiterated his plan to impose tariffs on imports.
They tax us. Forgetting just for a second about the word tariff. They tax us. We tax them. And they tax us almost in all cases. They're taxing us, and we haven't been taxing yet.
That's President-elect Trump in Mar-a-Lago at his press conference. He spoke about vaccines, Israel, the economy, drones, Syria, and a wide range of other topics. Turning now to our other top story, families are returning to Aleppo, Syria's second largest city, leaving behind tents in the countryside and life abroad as refugees. But some people, they're not yet able to enjoy what they hope will be the end of Syria's 13-year civil war. VOA's Heather Murdoch is there.
We're here in Aleppo, Syria's southern city. It's been 1 week since the fall of the government of Bashar al-Assad, but it has been 2 weeks since rebel forces took over the city.
Locals say the markets here are getting busier every day. And we meet people from all over Syria, as well as Syrians who have returned from abroad after living as refugees for years. In the past week, what were once rebel forces have begun setting up a government that works with some of the institutions and departments in place under the Assad regime. Many people tell us they're hopeful that the Syrian civil war is ending after 13 years of violence that killed 500,000 people and displaced half the country's population.
Other people tell us that they are so upset and angry that they have not yet found their loved ones who are lost in Syria's notorious prison system, that they cannot yet enjoy Syria's inherent newfound peace. Reporting from Aleppo, Syria, Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
And just as some people are headed home to Aleppo, some are headed home to northern Israel as well. More than 60,000 residents of northern Israel were evacuated 14 months ago when Hezbollah began bombing the area in support of Hamas and its war against Israel. Now, as a tenuous ceasefire with Hezbollah takes hold, some Israeli residents are returning, and others are choosing to wait it out and see what happens. Linda Gradstein reports from the Israeli city of Kiryat Shmona, near the border with Lebanon.
Together with more than 60,000 residents of northern Israel, most of Kiryat Shmona's residents were evacuated 2 weeks after Hezbollah began firing rockets at the border area in October 2023. City officials say about 1,000 homes have been destroyed by either direct missile hits or by shrapnel when Israel's Iron Dome missile interception system shot the rockets down. But now that a ceasefire with Lebanon has taken hold, some residents are returning to at least check on their homes. Yotam Dagani works for the Kiryat Shmona municipality.
People are definitely starting to come back to look at their houses, but we're probably looking at a prolonged period of time in which the residents will come back. We have to wait to see if the ceasefire holds.
Achi Natan is one of the 3,000 out of 24,000 residents who stayed in the city since the beginning of the war. He served as an army reservist in the local security squad. He was fortunate that his mother, sister, and sister's children had already been evacuated when their house was hit in a Hezbollah rocket attack. Natan believes Israel agreed too quickly to a ceasefire with Lebanon.
It was the wrong decision to stop because we don't really feel like it was finished. We pushed Hezbollah back, but we think they'll return and there'll be another October the 7th, this time here in the north.
On nearby Kibbutz Dafna, hundreds of avocado trees have been destroyed by a fire sparked by a missile strike. Most of the trees will have to be cut down, says Dafna farmer Magen Shinhav, and the damage will amount to hundreds of thousands of dollars.
It's part of the war, and we're not the only one who suffered, and still it's trees and not humans, so I prefer it will be trees and not casualties.
Like all of the 1,000 residents of this border community, Shinhav's family was evacuated more than a year ago. He says they are waiting to see what happens with the Lebanon ceasefire before they think of returning. But some people are not waiting. Barry and Orit Prague moved back to the kibbutz in June and stayed through the heavy missile attacks in September and October. Their son's house was damaged in one attack.
I came back because I see Dafna is my home. I believe in living here. I want to live too. I was born here. I always grew up next to the border.
Most of the more than 60,000 evacuees who live near the Lebanon border are carefully watching events in nearby Syria unfold. But their most immediate concern is whether the Lebanon ceasefire holds during the next two-month trial period. If it does, most say they will return home. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Kiryat Shmona, near Israel's border with Lebanon.
As we just heard, Lebanon yet again was at the center of a regional upheaval this year as Israel launched raids and heavy strikes in response to attacks from Hezbollah. A fragile ceasefire in November has silenced the bombing, at least temporarily, but will the regime change in neighboring Syria threaten more instability in 2025? VOA's Jacob Russell reports from Beirut.
Even by Lebanon standards, 2024 was a tumultuous year. War between Hezbollah and Israel engulfed the country after simmering along the border for almost a year. Hezbollah's powerful and charismatic leader, Hassan Nasrallah, was killed, along with much of the senior leadership. Previously a major political force in Lebanon and a staunch Iranian ally, the party was left reeling and agreed to ceasefire conditions at the end of November. Paul Salem is Vice President of International Engagement at the Middle East Institute.
I think Iran and you know what's left of Hezbollah have calculated that they need a de-escalation. They need several years of calm and stability to figure out the way forward for Iran and for themselves, for their strategy to rebuild Hezbollah.
But calm and stability are proving elusive. Barely hours after the ceasefire went into effect, November 27th, rebels in neighboring Syria launched a large-scale offensive that within 2 weeks toppled the Assad regime after more than 13 years of civil war. Hezbollah has been pivotal in keeping Assad in power. Nizar Ghanem is director of research at the Alternative Policy Institute.
In a war with all these variables, you understand fully well, as any force would in Syria, that you just had a chance. Hezbollah is downgraded. Iran is struggling. Russia is struggling in Ukraine. It's the right time to move.
The fall of Assad cut off supply routes between Iran and an already weakened Hezbollah. Along with ceasefire conditions that call for Hezbollah to pull back from the Israeli border, analysts see a window of opportunity for Lebanon. The Middle East Institute's Paul Salem.
South Lebanon no longer serves a strategic military function for Iran. That's a blessing for Lebanon. That means they're not going to invest in major military presence in southern Lebanon.
As ever, there is a delicate balance to be struck. Hezbollah has been a major regional player for decades and maintains a large and loyal civilian constituency in Lebanon. Its collapse would leave a dangerous vacuum. Nizar Ghanem at the Alternative Policy Institute.
But if we're going to go for a full crushing defeat of Hezbollah on the level of, like Ba'ath in Iraq, we're going to see an endless war in the region where car bombs go from Baghdad all the way to Jerusalem. Lebanon itself would fall apart.
With events unfolding across the region at a rapid pace, Lebanon faces major uncertainty in 2025, and its people are bracing for another year of violence. Jacob Russell, VOA News, Beirut.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Chancellor Olaf Scholz of Germany lost a confidence vote in the German parliament on Monday, putting the European Union's most populous member and biggest economy on course to hold an early election in February. Scholz leads a minority government after his unpopular and notoriously rancorous three-party coalition collapsed on November 6th. That's when he fired his finance minister in a dispute over how to revitalize Germany's stagnant economy. On Monday, a former FBI informant pleaded guilty to lying about a phony bribery scheme involving President Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden. That became central to the Republicans' impeachment inquiry against President Biden in Congress. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Ghana's president-elect, John Mahama, has outlined his vision for improving the life of the average Ghanaian following his victory in last week's general elections. Mahama, who campaigned on reviving Ghana's struggling economy and tackling unemployment, discussed his plans for job creation, school reform, and preserving the environment while allowing small-scale miners to make a living. Watch the interview at voanews.com. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Time again for our look at U.S. politics and the presidential transition. American farmers are hopeful that President-elect Trump's selection to head the U.S. Department of Agriculture will understand their concerns while guiding trade policy and farm legislation. VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports from Chicago.
Henry County, Illinois farmer Steve Nightingale and hundreds more from the statewide agricultural community gathered at the Illinois Farm Bureau's annual meeting this month in Chicago to discuss the path forward amid uncertainty about U.S. trade policy.
The farm economy is not great right now. The potential for tariffs, the combination of those two make any decision, gets you a little nervous.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's forecasts for 2024 show farmers across the United States losing nearly a quarter of their net farm income compared to the 2022 peak, while prices for inputs like fertilizer are near all-time highs. Nightingale is concerned about further economic turmoil if social media posts by President-elect Donald Trump outlining tariffs on some U.S. trading partners become policy.
When other countries retaliate against us, they go after the bread and butter, which is agriculture.
Nightingale, the president of the Henry County Farm Bureau, hopes Trump's pick to head the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins, understands his concerns about tariffs and the importance of passing a new farm bill to replace one that expired earlier this year.
We were kind of surprised because her name was never on any of the lists that we were seeing.
David Eiserman farms outside Streeter, Illinois, in LaSalle County, one of the top corn and soybean producing counties in the country.
She doesn't really have that background that some of the other ag secretaries have had, but that doesn't mean she'll be a bad one, so we'll just have to wait and see.
Rollins, who served in the previous Trump administration as the acting director of the White House Domestic Policy Council, graduated from Texas A&M University with a degree in agricultural management.
So she's got some ag background, and hopefully she's going to come in with an open mind and be supportive of farmers. And she said she is.
Iserman is also trying to have an open mind about transforming U.S. trade policy.
And until he takes office, until the new president takes office, we're really not going to know what's going to happen. But I know we've heard he's had talks with Canada, and supposedly those were productive. So maybe it's working in the case of Canada.
I just don't want an agriculture model that's built on government policy.
Dan Miller is the CEO of Steward, which crowdsources investors, connecting them with farmers and other producers. Miller says tariffs may encourage greater diversity in what U.S. farmers grow and where they sell it, shifting from reliance on exporting corn and soybeans to increased production of other crops.
We have a model that's built on huge amount of policy and government support. Most farmers I work with would prefer not to have that. They're just stuck in it. You know, they grow corn and soy because they can drop it at the elevator, get paid.
Miller acknowledges shifting production of any crop is a lengthy, expensive, and complicated process requiring new infrastructure, but hopes debate about tariffs and U.S. agricultural policy allows for policy to shift.
We just want a free market.
While Nightingale wants new buyers for corn and soybean crops, Iserman would settle for more certainty in U.S. trade and agricultural policy.
We're using us as a pawn, agriculture as a pawn, and that concerns me.
Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
Ukraine has confirmation that North Korean troops are involved in the fighting in the Kursk region of Russia. More from VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that he has confirmation of North Korean troops' involvement in ground assaults against Ukrainian forces in the Kursk region of Russia. Zelensky noted that at present, their involvement was only confirmed in Kursk, but Ukraine has information that they may be used in other parts of the front line, including inside Ukrainian territory. Zelensky called it an escalation from the Russian side. Zelensky also said that according to the report from Alexander Sirsky, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine, there were casualties among the North Korean troops. Preliminary data suggests that the Russian forces are trying to conceal these losses. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller also confirmed this and said that after they were deployed to the Kursk operation, they became legitimate targets for the Ukrainian military. Miller told VOA in a press conference Monday that if they cross the border into Ukraine, that would be yet another escalation by the government of Russia and also an escalation by the government of North Korea.
We have seen North Korean soldiers who have been killed in action on the battlefield inside Russia. And if they were to cross the border into Ukraine, that would be yet another escalation by the government of Russia and also an escalation by the government of North Korea.
Over the weekend, Russian forces continued to conduct missile and drone attacks across Ukraine, targeting energy infrastructure. According to the Ministry of Energy of Ukraine, since October 2022, Russia has carried out over 1,000 strikes on Ukrainian energy infrastructure facilities. Meanwhile, President Zelensky said Ukraine is ready to provide food assistance to Syria under its Grain from Ukraine humanitarian program. He said Ukraine can help Syrians with Ukrainian wheat, flour, and oil to ensure food security in the vulnerable region. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
There's been another school shooting in the United States, this time in Wisconsin. Three people are dead, including the shooter. Haya Panjwani from the Associated Press has more.
A teenage student opened fire at a private Christian school in Wisconsin, killing a teacher and another teenage student in the final week before Christmas break. Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes said police received a call from the school and staff at a nearby police training center responded from there.
So what began as a training day became an actual day.
He did not give details about the age or gender of the suspected shooter, who also wounded six others at Abundant Life Christian School, a K-12 school with about 390 students. Barnes said the suspected shooter likely died by suicide. He also said investigators didn't have a motive yet.
I don't know why, and I felt like if we did know why, we could stop these things from happening.
News conference audio courtesy of WKOW. I'm Haya Panjwani.
Hundreds, perhaps thousands, are dead in Mayotte, a French territory in the Indian Ocean off the east coast of southern Africa, near Madagascar. Cyclone Chido was the worst storm to hit the area in almost a century. Alice Rizzo of Reuters has our story.
Emergency workers were searching for survivors in the French overseas territory Mayotte on Monday, where hundreds or maybe thousands are feared dead. That's after Cyclone Chido devastated large parts of the Indian Ocean islands over the weekend. It is the worst cyclone to hit the archipelago, located off the east coast of Africa, in nearly a century. The aftermath of the cyclone saw hillsides littered with the wreckage of hundreds of makeshift homes. The full extent of casualties and physical damage remains unclear. On Monday, maritime and aerial operations were underway to deliver relief supplies and equipment, French authorities said. Despite these efforts, significant challenges remain. Parts of the islands were still inaccessible to rescue workers on Monday, according to a civil security spokesperson. Mayotte, which lies between Mozambique and Madagascar, is made up of two main islands and has a population of about 321,000. It is significantly poorer than the rest of France and has grappled with gang violence and social unrest for decades. Extreme weather events have become more common around the globe, in keeping with global warming. And poorer nations often say they are bearing the brunt of the environmental crisis.
That's Alice Rizzo of Reuters reporting for us today. And elsewhere in Africa, Human Rights Watch has accused Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces and allied militias of rape and other acts of sexual violence against women and girls in the South Kordofan state. The rights group says sexual violence constitutes war crimes, and it underscores the urgent need for international action to protect civilians. Mohamed Youssef reports.
Human Rights Watch says representatives met with raped or sexually abused women in Sudan's South Kordofan state during their visit this past October. The women from the Nuba minority ethnic group say they were violated and exploited by members of Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces and allied militias. The RSF was not available to respond to the allegations against its fighters. Belkis Will is an associate director in the Crisis, Conflict and Armed Division at Human Rights Watch.
In this new report of Human Rights Watch, we have included details that we gathered into the cases of 79 women and girls who were raped by the RSF, including girls as young as 7 years old. And indeed, we also documented the case of a group of 51 women and girls who were taken by the RSF and held on a military base and used as sex slaves for months.
The survivors and witnesses told investigators that they had been gang raped since December 2023, and some of the victims were still missing. Local and international rights groups have documented many alleged human rights violations by both the RSF and the Sudanese armed forces since the sides went to war in April 2023, battling for power and control of the country. The International Criminal Court in The Hague issued an arrest warrant in 2009 against former President Omar al-Bashir and some commanders of militia groups on allegations of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity in the Darfur region. Experts say the failure to hand over Bashir, who was ousted in 2019, is now being held at a military hospital on the outskirts of Khartoum, is one factor that is fueling the conflict in Sudan. Will of Human Rights Watch says survivors and victims of sexual violence need justice and protection.
It's really important, first and foremost, for the RSF to take action against these abuses. That means investigating their own forces for carrying out incidents of rape. It means immediately releasing any women and girls that are still being held and ensuring that these kind of acts don't continue. But we do need to see leadership from other actors as well. The UN Security Council, the African Union could do far more, for example, creating this mission with a mandate to protect civilians that could be sent into Sudan.
As the violence and suffering of Sudanese civilians continued, in September, Sudan's military-led government rejected a UN plan to deploy a mission to protect civilians. Mohamed Youssef, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
Thank you.